That's what I hear when you bring heartache over to my place. You've done it over and over. Way, watching the clock in dismay. Just at midnight, where do you think you're going?
This is J.D. Doyle, and welcome to Queer Music Heritage. You just heard the song Red Hot Tears from the new album by Eric Hyman called Gracefully. I've been a fan of his for many years, and I'm honored to share with you an interview with Eric starting right now. Eric, I just opened the segment with the opening track from your CD, and while it's still fresh, could you talk about that song?
First of all, thanks for having me on. The opening track is called Red Hot Tears. I wrote Red Hot Tears because I had a visual of that after hearing the word red hot for a bunch of things, you know, just a lot of advertising. But then when I thought of Red Hot Tears, I just had that title, and I ended up thinking of, like, how can I flesh this out? Because the idea of being hurt so much that it causes you physical pain, you know, like, what would that be? And I feel like it would be something where you would just be pining over somebody who just kept breaking your heart. So that's kind of what the song is about. And has the horn section on it and my backup girls on it. Just a whole different sound and a different style. So I wanted to kick off the CD as different as I've ever have.
I love the horns on the album.
Oh, thank you.
I've been following your career for quite a while, you know that.
How many
CDs and EPs have you released so far?
Oh my God. You know, I probably should be counting, but I think I'm scared to count because that just means I've been doing it for way too long. But I would say that this is like my ninth studio album.
I counted, and I didn't go by studio album, but in total, I've got 13, including the DVD.
Oh, wow. Jeez.
Okay, so tell us about the new CD.
The new CD is, it feels like the most complete, solid album I think I've ever done. And in where all the songs kind of evolved at around the same time, and they all seem to be compatible with each other. You know, on my other CDs, I feel like, you know, Resonate seemed pretty compatible with all the songs. But sometimes I like to write in different genres, and then you have a very country-sounding song next to a very singer-songwriter song, and then a very hard rock song. You know, it bounced around genres, and that's just because I have this love of so many different styles. But to have an album like Gracefully, where I feel like all my influences are in there, they seem to have a little bit of all of those things.
What was the inspiration for the title track?
My grandmother raised me. My mom passed away when I was 4, and so my grandmother was like my mother figure, and she was an artist. She could draw, she could paint, she did needlepoint. She was a colorist for DC Comics from the 30s.
Wow.
And she was a photographer's assistant. She was just an amazing, amazing artist woman. And she passed away at 97 last August while I was figuring out how I was going to do this album. And I ended up writing Gracefully about her because, you know, I couldn't call her. And there were so many times that things happened in my life after she passed away. So that song was my phone call to her.
I wish that I could just tell you all of the things that
before I was ready to let you go. And I hear you whisper, don't worry. And I'd hear you say, I'll see you in heaven. Well, heaven is where we will meet. And we'll be together like we were meant to be. But for now I must live my life like you taught me. But for now I must live my life like you taught me. Our goodbye is just for a while. And if so, tell Grandpa Hal and Jerry and Sandy, Cheryl and Mom that I will see them. Ooh, I'll see them.
What inspired the song Call Me Up?
I've had a few friends in my life who I've worried about, you know, where I thought they were being a little self-destructive, or they've made mention to me, like, you know, I had one friend who said, what's it even matter? You know, I'm never going to find anybody. I'm never going to, you know, like, they just take you down these roads and then you walk away thinking, God, and you don't know what to say to them. You know, no, you'll find somebody. No, everything's going well. No, you're just going through a rough patch. I felt like so many people were saying that to me in different parts of my life that I just wanted to write a song that was like, I'm worried about you, and I just want you to know, before you do anything, like, just call me. Give me a chance to get in the way of you and something horrible happening to you.
And you won't stop, and I fear that I will find you once the damage is done. Why do you wait for magic like you would a friend who has promised to see to it you'll feel whole again? It's these times when you can't catch your breath that any sign of relief
safest bet. Why don't you call me up? Why don't you call me up? When the time feels right for a wrongful death, why don't you pick up the phone with whatever is left and call me up? See you window shopping with your eyes, watching the prettiest of people as they go by, then glance down at yourself to criticize. It's this habit of society to copy fitting standards in a way that most of us can't. Why don't you call me up? Why don't you call me up? When the time feels right for a wrongful death, why don't you pick up the phone with whatever is left and call me up? Why don't you call me
Again, that was the song Call Me Up, and due to time constraints, regretfully, I had to shorten many of the songs on this show. Who have been your musical influences?
Oh my God, I feel like I jumped genre, again, like with a genre thing. They change, you know, every time I get asked that, I feel like I name different people. When I started out, I was very highly influenced by Ani DiFranco, and I'm still influenced by all these people, but some more at different times in my life than others. Ani DiFranco, Tracy Chapman, Patti Griffin, Dar Williams, Lori McKenna, like a lot of my singer-songwriter women, you know, that style of music really influenced me in the beginning. And then I found, you know, Etta James and Aretha Franklin and Big Mama Thornton and Diana Krall at one point. You know, I just went through this phase of listening to jazz and listening to blues and listening to soul and then, I don't know, I feel like I found my way on my last CD, Supposed Unknown, back to the singer-songwriter thing, and I was highly influenced by a friend of mine, you know, who I was lucky to be friends with, and that's Nomalee Brennett. Not only was I influenced by her, but I got to make the CD with her. And at this time, I mean, there's something about going back to soul music and folk music, and it kind of merges with people like Bill Withers, you know, who's a little bit of both. So, I don't know, Bill Withers, Bonnie Raitt, these tried and true people who aren't flashy, who aren't gimmicky, who just write good songs and let their work speak for themselves. They don't do anything to be anything more than just consistently great.
Another song I like from the new one is called The Only Way. Could you talk about it?
It's weird. I mean, there's always the songs that you're more proud of than other ones, I have to say. You know, when you put them all next to each other, a lot of people say, oh, my songs are my children and I can't pick one. I mean, it's art. You know, some things you feel more proud of than other ones. You know, they're all still good to me and they're all worthy of being on this album. But there's songs that you want, you know, you want people to compliment you on. And that took maybe more time and didn't come as easy. And The Only Way is that song for me. You know, that's actually one of the first songs I wrote for this album because I thought, you know, I compare myself sometimes to other artists and their careers and, you know, especially when there's a whole flash in the pan kind of artist that comes out and you're like, what am I doing wrong? You know, like, how do I get attention? You know, when you're doing everything on your own, you're juggling so many different plates. To see somebody doing really well quickly and fleetingly in the end, you get a little jealous of it and you want that for yourself. So every time I felt like, you know, this can't be the only way to do things. you know, and that kind of resonated into a lot of things in my life. You know, this can't be it. And there's a few lines in that song where I felt like I really hammered at it and ended up with, you know, thinking about religion. One of the lines is, I bet religion has doubt built in because everyone can sink, not everyone can swim. And I really am proud of lines like that because when I hear other artists like Ani, and they always seem to have that one line in it that really strikes you, you know, that really says that they're not just writing words to fill spaces. You know, there's like a poetry to it.
There's some thought behind it.
Oh, yeah. And that song has more thought behind it, I think, than any of them.
This job done. Hear my fear whisper, things can only get worse. Have to trust that they can as easily get better first. This world holds the strong world under me. Really do we see the majority? In between, on the seesaw ride, who do you listen to when you can't trust either side? When I plan, I leave a little time in between to rest. Beat myself up better than you could. The harshest critic lives in my neighborhood. I bet religion has doubt built in. Cause everyone can sink, not everyone can swim. Takes courage to differentiate. Where to place your caution and where to place your faith.
The song Symmetry seems like an especially personal one.
Yeah, more personal than I'd like to be. But the story of Symmetry was just too important to me that I really wanted to put it out there. A friend of mine was one of those people that didn't get what gay people are about. And I felt like I was tolerated and not necessarily accepted. And I, in turn, accepted that tolerance. And I just thought, well, they'll come around. And like what a lot of, I think, gay people do with people that are close to them is, you know, give them time. You know, I don't want to push it. And then you make a lot of excuses for yourself and not standing up for yourself. And then I also had a trainer who I had been working with, a personal trainer, that I became friends with. And he went to a Bible college. And he was the same way, where he did this whole thing where he's like, I don't agree with your life, but I think you're nice and we can be friends. And I accepted that for a while, thinking he'll come around, or, you know, maybe we agree to disagree is not such a bad thing. But then the more situations that came up in my life, getting married, things like that, I was happy to talk about. I thought, you know what? I'm going to stop making excuses for people and take people as they are and just accept that, you know what, maybe you and me aren't the same at all. You know, maybe between you and me, there's no symmetry. And that's where that line came from. And the very personal part is I had invited that trainer to my wedding because I had been working with him for a long time, and he said no. And he said no because God, and he said it, funny, he said it in a nice way. Like, he sat me down, and he was said he was very happy that he was invited, but he said that he had spoke with God that morning, and that God told him that coming to the wedding would be such a good idea, and he had to listen to his father. That's when I went home and thought about it, and I kind of was like, oh, okay, whatever, and like, just try to get out of there as quickly as possible, because I didn't know what to say. And then when I found the words, that's how they ended up in the song, where it's like, I know that you mean well, but this comes as a slap, because I've spoken with God too, and he's never said that. You know, because a lot of, I think, religious people assume that, especially like very anti-gay religious people, assume that we don't have God in our life either. So to me, for you to tell me God told you not to come to my wedding, and, you know, I'm also a believer in God, so God just told you and he didn't tell me, you know, like, it just seemed presumptuous. So that's kind of where that song came from.
In your living room, I'd like to think we had a laugh or two, safe inside from opposing views. I became the exception when I played by the rules. It's getting harder and harder to excuse the biting things you say. I miss the sweet words you use, but this time you threw me over the edge. It's gonna take longer to get back than it ever has. Now your troubles have caught you like a to my heart in the past. So it braced when a new friend's faith shadow was cast. And the I told you so came on my wedding day. He said he couldn't attend cause God told him no way. I said I know that you mean well, but this comes as to laugh, 'cause I've spoken with God too, and he's never said that. So your God and my God will have to agree. That between you and me there's no symmetry. Between you and me there's no symmetry. Between you and me, there's no symmetry. Between you and me, there's no symmetry. Well, on the piano bench in your living room, I'd like to think we had a laugh or two.
Well, reflecting on that song, now that you have a husband, how has that changed or colored your creative process?
I feel a little bit like everybody's going to assume that everything I write about in terms of relationships is always going to be him. You know, whether it's not him or whether I'm talking about a friend or a family member, I feel like when you deliver in a certain way, it always ends up being like, oh, are you guys on the rocks? Do you know what I mean? Like, any creative writing I do is in turn, even though a lot of them come from my real life, is just going to always be about him. And he's great about it, and he accepts that, and he's never, you know, he's never once affected my writing style by or influenced it in any way to be less about him or more about him. He just accepts me and my music for what it is, and he doesn't get in my process whatsoever.
I want to talk just for a couple moments about the article for The Advocate. I cheered when you wrote that op-ed article about Pride festivities. And in full disclosure for my listeners, Eric contacted me when he was working on the piece, and we discussed various issues, and he even quoted me, but Eric, it was definitely your article, and I thought it was wonderful. Talk a little about what prompted it and what message were you trying to get across?
The message I was trying to get across was that I just had this idea that after playing a bunch of prides and seeing the kind of acts that ended up getting the most exposure, I thought more and more it became about being this, you know, dance party. And to me, and throughout the article and then after I wrote the article, you know, the reaction to it, I felt like everybody has a different idea of what Pride is. Like, that's the great thing about it, and that's also the hard thing about marketing it or probably booking bands for it or anything, is that everybody has a completely different idea of what Pride parades and Pride festivals should represent. Some people, it's a giant party, and it's just a celebration in general. Other people, like me, think back to the 60s, it's like a protest. It's like a peaceful protest, you know, where you're talking about the issues at hand and you're gathering for a big reason to show your numbers and strength. Sometimes I just felt like it was swinging so much to being just a big dance party that I would look at some of these stages that I was like maybe the only gay performer on. And everybody else was, you know, just there to make, you know, their money and do their performance. And a lot of them just had no relationship to the gay community. My article was about, you know, where are the transgendered artists? Where are the gay artists? Where is our community? Because to me, Pride used to be, for me, about going and seeing people on a stage that were out and gay and successful and had something to say and were empowering. And then I look up there now and it's just somebody singing a pop song from some other time period and dancing around, which has its place. But to me, I don't see myself on that stage anymore in terms of that. And this is a conversation somebody just posted on Facebook about, talking about Dan Savage, where he said, our young people don't even know anything about the gay rights movement. And they don't even care to know about it. So to me, it's even more important to have successful gay artists, the majority of them be a representation of our community. And it's Pride. So I wrote about it. I wrote this article about it. And the reaction was tremendously positive. But I thought, at first I thought, oh my God, all these prides are going to be like, don't book Eric Hyman.
Well, I much admire you for writing that piece.
Oh, thank you. I mean, yeah, those are the moments where I feel like, you know, you really put yourself out there and you're willing to accept the consequences of it. For me, I wanted to see that change and I wasn't going to wait for anybody else to bring it up. Hi, this is Eric Hyman, and you're listening to Queer Music Heritage.
And that kind of signals a change in the segment. Up to now, we've been talking about the music from Eric's new CD, Gracefully. But as I've said, I've admired his work for many years, so cannot pass up asking him about some of the songs from past releases. Do you have any idea on the websites like iTunes and Amazon, what song seems to be your biggest seller?
One of my biggest sellers of my songs are the songs that end up getting put into rotation more on Coffee House. You know, that to me was a big break, you know, having them like my music and putting it on in rotation. Because satellite radio is new and it's kind of different and a little bit off the beaten path of, I think, regular radio. You know, they have a little more opportunity to provide more up-and-coming artists. I never thought that, but when they started playing, you know, Stay the Afternoon as much as they did, it made a real impact. And then they asked me to come and do live sessions, and that was amazing. And then with this album, I did a special version of Everything to You, where I kind of pulled out the drums and pulled out the horns and made it a little more suitable for their station. So I think the songs that they end up playing are the ones that end up getting at the top of my most, you know, purchased songs, which is Save the Afternoon, Now Everything to You, and they play a cover I did of Simply Red's Holding Back the Years, and that's up there as well.
I looked at iTunes, and you can sort an artist's MP3 list, and you can ask it to do most popular, and I'm not sure how valid their mechanisms are, but Save the Afternoon was number one. Could you talk about that song?
Save the Afternoon, I think I had this idea that when you have these stupid little fights, you know, with the person that you're with based on you're cranky or somebody's cranky or somebody didn't get enough sleep or somebody didn't eat anything that day and then you're fighting over, you know, who didn't take out the garbage or who didn't feed the dogs or, you know, just these little things that every once in a while, you know, just somehow something will put fuel on the fire and it ends up being like an escalated thing where you're like, I don't know if I can do this anymore. You know, very dramatic, very, probably not anything to do with your relationship, just more to do with, you know, tension and tempers. But I like this idea of like just saying, you know, can we just both, and which is funny because me and my husband are like that, you know, there's a point where where we just end up laughing, you know, when it's something stupid and silly, like one of us will just get over dramatic and the other one will laugh and then it's over. And to me that was the idea of Save the Afternoon, which is like, can one of us just laugh and then not let this like go from the morning all the way until the end of the day.
There are lines that we set up as you and I become us. When we start, there is less struggle when they cross. But on days already rough, the lines get close enough to touch, and the smallest movement sets all the alarms off. It takes so long to find, can easily get lost. Some after days, some after breaths, and I know my pride can get the best of me. But this is not some massive fire destroying fields hour by hour, but it burns me up a bit when you leave angry. So before you go, please listen to me.
Considering songs that you've written a number of years ago, can you think of any where your relationship to the song has changed?
Yes. I had written a song for my partner's mom who was diagnosed with breast cancer. She had it for over, I think it was the course of like 5 years. But I met my partner like 3 years into her having breast cancer, where it went away and then it came back. And then it went away again, and then it came back. And I was there towards the tail end when it really came back. It came back very strong. And I lost my mom when I was so young, so to have this second mom that kind of showed up, you know, with my partner, I mean, I got very attached to her very quickly. And I wrote the song for her called What I Can Give, because in those moments when somebody is going through something so horrible and so life-threatening, no consoling words ever feel enough. It almost seems like insulting to just be like, you know, get well or feel better or
have a nice day, you know.
Or have a nice day. And I loved her, and I didn't want to say that to her and it come off sounding trite. So I wrote her this song, and it basically was just saying, you know, like, all I can give you is a song. You know, this is what I can give you, and just let you know that I care about you and I love you and I want to see you, you know, make it through this. And she heard the song before she really got sick, and she cried and she said she loved it, and that to me was an amazing moment. And then when she passed away, my partner's family had asked, since it was so specific to her, if they could play it during her slideshow at her funeral. And boy, I have never cried in my life as loud as I cried the minute I saw the photo, the minute we were in the church and the slideshow's going and my song comes on. You know, it's like I didn't intend for it to be like that, and it seemed very sad to me, you know, that it was at the end of her life that this song kind of came back. But maybe 6 months later, I was playing in Jackson, Mississippi, and these two women, two awesome women, came up to me and said, oh, my God, we love your music. We've been, you know, listening to you for a long time. One of your songs is our song. Please, you know, can we request that you play it at the end of your set? We're going to dance. And I thought that was just really the coolest thing. And I was, you know, smiling and talking to them. And I said, oh, that's so awesome. What's the song? And they said, What I Can Give. And I was like, wait a minute. In my mind, I thought, that can't be about you. Like, that can't be about your positive relationship. And how can that be about it? And then I'm sitting there while they're talking to me, and I'm thinking about the words of the song, and I realized that I stopped myself from feeling like I had to, like, inform them of what the intention of that song was. And I played it. And as I was playing it, I was listening to my own words come back to me, and I realized that it could be interpreted as something very positive and basically saying, you know, I love you and I care about you, and I basically all I can do is just give you the song just to let you know that I care about you. And it applied. So now when I play that song, those two amazing women really helped me cope with never feeling like I wanted to play that song again.
Well, I wish I had a song to sing for you, to gather the strength that each day must take to go through what you do, what you do. So many things that we take for granted too easily. One day it hits, remind us the courage it takes not to quit, not to quit. I could offer
10,000 tears, a field of white daffodils. With these things, what could you do? But this is what I can give to you. But this is what I can give to you. May not be much you've been through enough, just know it's me you have touched. Song to sing for you, to gather the strength that each day must take to go through what you do, what you do.
From the 2006 CD, Everywhere All at Once, that was What I Can Give.
Is there an overall message you hope your music gets across?
I think overall, I want there to be, the same genuine honesty, heart felt, thoughtful feelings that I get from listening to the artists that I look up to and I love, like a lot of the people that I named, you know, like Natalie Merchant, different people like that.
I asked you that same question back in 2005. I asked what the overall message you hope to get across, and you said, same answer, honesty.
That's good. Consistency. That should be part of that whole statement right there.
Eric, I want to cover some of my personal favorites from your earlier CDs. One of them is Little Boy Blue. Would you talk about it?
Little Boy Blue, I wrote about a transgendered boy. I did a tour of LGBT youth centers back in 2006, and, you know, I think I went in with a really wrong attitude. I think I went in there thinking, like, oh, I've been in, you know, all these things. I'm a lot older. I've been out for so long. I'm going to meet a lot of these kids, and hopefully they'll get my message, and they'll get what I'm about immediately. And I kind of just walked in there with a chip on my shoulder. And what happened, though, was, you know, they were like, who the hell are you? Like, what are you doing here? Like, they didn't know the media. They didn't know, like, who you are. You're just this guy showing up with a guitar wanting to talk to them. It was my responsibility to kind of preface who I was in my music and by talking and having conversations. And there was one boy there that was transgendered. That's the one thing I didn't expect, was that a lot of these LGBT centers, it wasn't just filled with young gay men and women. It was a lot of transgendered, you know, men and women. And I just didn't have that much experience with, you know, transgendered. So he didn't really take a good liking to me at the beginning. He didn't really understand why I was there. I wasn't there to, like, speak to him directly. But by the end of the day, once he let his guard down and I knocked the chip off my shoulder, or he did, I felt like we connected. And it was really amazing, and we kept in touch, and I kind of wanted to tell that story of going in and, like, thinking I was just going to reach out my hand and that, you know, everybody was going to be like, oh, we're so glad you're here. You know, I had to earn his respect. And that song is about that.
Strangers, and you refuse. In your they try to commend you, little boy blue, searching this ground up for your tooth, over gray mountains down and through, they don't understand you, but I do, but
another song I really love is Protest Song, and I think it's your most political work.
I think it is, too. It's funny, me and my aunt were sitting down, and we were talking about politics and stuff, and she's like, well, do you consider yourself an activist? And I was like, well, I don't really feel like, when I think of activists, I think of, you know, Million Man March and, like, people who are, you know, out there, and here I am, my activism is, you know, writing a song and singing it at my gigs. And she was mentioning all the songs that I had mentioned politics in. Like, I wrote You First about, you know, Gabrielle Giffords being shot, you know, and that whole experience of feeling safe, you know, when you really put yourself out there. So I've written a lot about politics, but I feel like I never directly addressed them like I did in Protest Song because it's so personal. And it's not only, like, it was not only in marriage, but in religion and then in the military. There were just so many different places that I feel were bigoted towards gay people. And back in 2008, when Prop 8 was gaining a lot of steam, that's when I wrote that song, you know, because I was fed up. And for a long time, everybody around me was asking me, like, oh, you need to write a song about being gay. You need to write a song about gay rights. You have to do it. You have to do it. You know, back in, you know, 2000, that song didn't come out till 2008 because I just didn't want to do it for its own sake. Like, I didn't want it to come off disingenuous. I didn't want to sit down and, like, force it. I wanted to feel it and have it come out honestly. And then when Prop 8 happened, it triggered me, and that song got written real fast. And that's why I think it's powerful, because it came in its own time.
Well, as that's your only political GLBT song, how did people react to it?
Oh, people reacted very strongly. You know, it put me in a place where I felt like I couldn't wait to get in front of a Pride crowd and sing it. I also felt a little nervous because people would ask me to play that song in very conservative places. You know, I'm playing like a bar, one of those bar gigs where you're playing mostly covers from, you know, 10 to 1. And then somebody would say, Protest Song! And then I'm thinking, I'm looking around and I know this is not a gay bar. This is not, you know, the people who are going to agree with me. And then I realized this is the place I have to be playing it. This is where people need to hear it. I don't need everybody just, you know, agreeing with me. This song needs to be heard by those who don't expect it.
They come to tell me that hell is at my door. How nice of them to warn me a whole lot of time before. I've got the rest of my life till Judgment Day is due. Oops, look at the time, I bet you got better things to do. I was not raised the way you were, and yes, I'm glad I was born this way. Get out of my face, do with it like I have. Do with it like I have. I am not a soldier, I am just an average man, living out my life the best way that I can. I'm not reporting for duty, I'm not recruiting myself. Join our forces that don't want me, unless they need my help, yeah. Unless they need my help, yeah. I said, General, I'm quite quite capable. My strength is my proof. Are you afraid I'll try to sleep with every soldier in my troop? Are you afraid I'd be the hero that you are looking for? And you'd have to thank my faggot ass for winning you your fucking war. I was not raised the way you were, and yes, I'm glad I was born this way. Get out of my face, do it like I am. Are under attack, and I agree. Every time I see a gay kid kicked out on his back, how can parents be so cruel? Throw you out with no remorse. If that was me, I'd say, if that was me, I'd say, I was not raised the way you were, and yes, I'm glad I was born this way. Sorry, I'm gay, do with it like I have.
This is J.D. Doyle for Queer Music Heritage, and I'm finishing up my interview with Eric Hyman. You can find a whole lot more about him at his site, logically at erichhyman.com, and I admit I do have a favorite of his songs, thank you for asking, and it's from his 2006 album, Everywhere All at Once, and we'll hear about that song to close the show. From your albums before the new one, is there a song that seems to be the overwhelming crowd favorite?
Bartender seems to be a crowd favorite. You know, wherever I play that, I feel like it's well recognized, and I'm very lucky at that, that you can have songs that seem to stick with people and that when they show up, they expect you to play them. That one gets requested quite often.
Well, Bartender is my favorite, and I also think it's the most commercial song. Have you thought of shopping it around Nashville to get some young country guy to sing it?
There's a bunch of my songs that I think would be interesting to be heard from country music and be covered. I hope somebody hears that someday and thinks, you know, that's a great song, and I think I could cover it and do a really good job. And I don't know. That's the biggest honor, is that anybody would want to sing your songs, whether they were the person down the street who's your friend who just likes you, or, you know, some big country act.
Let me get you to introduce the song Bartender.
Bartender is this song that I wrote with my friend Cass, my best friend, which makes it even more one of my favorites of mine. I wrote it with her when the lights went out in Pittsburgh, and we had nothing to do and an acoustic guitar, and we were making fun of the idea of hitting on bartenders and how we both had that mutual interest in them.
Must be the clothes or the lack thereof. Must be the way they spin a bottle of vodka. Must be the lights, dark and dim. Must be the way they lean on him. Tell me, why do I always fall in love with a bartender? Bartender, some kind of charm coming from behind the bar. Is that the bartender? Bartender. Thank you.
two shots. I need one for me, and how about one for you?
I look at you, the mixture, I am under your spell. Let's go for alcohol. Did you hear the bell? All round, if it was through, you hand me my tab. I asked you to call me, and you called me. Ooh, you called me
a cab.
Why do I always fall in love with a bartender, bartender, some kind of charm coming from behind the bar? Is that the bartender, bartender?